for that on our website. So today's speaker, we have Vice President Pamela Brown, and to introduce her today is our former co-vice chair, PACSA, Jenny Kao, and she's also the executive director of Impact Issues Management Analysis. Policy Analysis and Coordination. We have so many acronyms.
I know.
I hope you enjoy, and thank you.
Well done. Hi, everyone. I have the distinguished pleasure of introducing my colleague and my friend, Pamela Brown. I won't talk about her bio because you've all read it. I know she leads a team of really talented individuals in IRAP. I think 23 and counting?
Yep, and counting. I like that. That's good.
Absolutely. We share an administrative assistant, Sarah. All of you know Sarah. And, you know, we fight over that all the time.
Yeah, it's ugly.
That's right. Pamela and I are actually kindred spirits, even if you may not know it. We both attended Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
Go Bears.
Yeah, go Bears. We both, Bears are on a roll, kind of, so.
Kind of, yeah.
We both went to public policy school
for
our advanced degree. And we both started our UC careers at Berkeley, I think. Is that right?
That's right.
So,
wow.
I know. Who knew, right?
This was a great event. Thank you for having me.
But more important, I think that we, you can, other things that I think we have in common is you can always find us on email at all hours of the night.
That's not good.
That's not a good thing. And we both have really needy but adorable pets.
Yeah, that's true.
And we like to have fun at work.
That's all over.
All over. The reason why I admire Pamela is not because of her keen analytic ability or her data prowess or her really stellar ability to lead and manage a staff, her leadership skills. But really what I really love about Pamela, what I've observed, is that she has a great sense of humor and always brings that with her. She never, ever takes herself too seriously or this place too seriously. And
she's really important.
Yeah, exactly. She's really important.
Yeah.
And also, what I've noticed being in a lot of different meetings with her is she always raises her hand to tackle the hairy project, the ugly one, the one that people don't want to do. And I'm always telling my own staff, you know, you need to raise your hand. If you want to advance and, you know, be seen as a leader, you need to raise your hand. That's my favorite thing to say to people. Some of my staff right here rolling their eyes right now.
That's what folks are going, you're raising your hand?
Exactly.
I thought we told you not to do that.
So, but I always see Pamela, you know, step up in any kind of setting to do that. And it doesn't matter how tough the going gets, she gets going. And she, you know, takes everything, like I said, with a smile and with great wit and humor and, of course, great capabilities. And I think her talk actually is right around the time last year that you started.
Yeah, that's right.
Right? Exactly. So the talk also marks Pamela's first anniversary at UCOP. We're so lucky to have her here. It's been one short year, and I can't even imagine this place without you, really. She's a wonderful colleague and an even better friend, and I would join you in welcoming, with a warm welcome, Pamela Brown.
Well, that's very kind. I think I should probably end it right there, and thank you all for coming.
That was very good. Jenny's right. It's my one-year anniversary. That was last week, and it feels like it's been like an amazing year that's lasted like five or something like that, and then it seems like it goes by short, which means it's usually good. And to have the honor of coming here today to speak to you in this series, which I've really enjoyed so early in my tenure here, is very kind. I said it was like Barack Obama getting the Nobel Prize right at the beginning. I don't want to peak too soon, you know. So I started by humbling myself by going through and trying to pull out some other folks that I look up to as a starting point to ground me in what's appropriate. Some of you have already heard my story, so I beg you to indulge me to tell it one more time, and then I'll create a new one along the way. But I often introduce myself, and I say that I've been married three times to the same woman. And she's sitting in the back row there, which I thought that she's in the back row there. So this is us, and you can barely see this one. This is old school time, but we'll walk you through our emotional roller coaster that we've had, which is all the marriages that we've gone through together. and the story about it. The first one is back, watch this, I'm going to do this. It's like 2001. We had a commitment ceremony. I got that right. We had a commitment ceremony up in Tilden Park at the Brazilian Room. I don't know if you've ever been up there. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. But it was a point in time where we couldn't register as domestic partners or do anything like that. But we wanted to make things clear to our family. So we brought everyone together in a wonderful space. My mother wrote a passage. Our father wrote read a poem. We brought everyone together. It was really good. And because there were no rules, we worked with our officiant, who's been with us throughout all these years, to figure out what kind of ceremony we had. And there was no marriage license to sign or anything like that. So what we did was we went out and we got a ketubah, which is a Jewish wedding document, and we made it Quaker, which meant we had everybody that joined us come and sign the document. And so we have that up in our house. We don't have it up there now because we're doing a remodel. But it's the one thing we'll grab Shauna, the dogs, and the ketubah should anything happen in the house. It's a very special document for us. So that was then. Then 2004 comes along, and Gavin Newsom opens the doors of City Hall, and we saw that happen. I think it was on the 12th of February. It was right in the evening couples got to start to get married. And so we sort of looked at one another, and then we looked at what our schedule looked like in the morning, and we weren't sure what would happen. There was a lot of uncertainty about when they might shut it down and what would happen. So we got up really, really early the next morning, about like 5:30 or 6, and we drove over to the city because we figured we'd be like in the first in line and that. And there were already at least 100 couples that were in line, and we stood there that morning. And it was really amazing. I mean, as we were there, the line continued to grow. And if you remember, it just kept going. And through the rain, couples stood there. But we were able to go through that morning and went up the steps of City Hall up at the top. And we found two folks we'd never, ever met before, but they were so kind. And they took pictures of us. And we went through, and then were announced spouses for life. And that was really, really an amazing communal experience and something we'll never forget. And then you go through the roller coaster, right? The marriages get nullified, and you have to kind of, you sort of know that's going to happen, or it's possible, but it's not fun. So we go through that, and then get more and more involved in what happens. And then in 2008, it all goes into the court system. 2008 comes along, and the California Supreme Court rules that gay couples can get married. And then this would be us down in Contra Costa County. We thought it was really important to go to Contra Costa County. That's our home county. We went there to pick up our license, and I remember, and we had our coffee. You can see that, because you got to stay caffeinated for the movement, you know. So we had our coffee, and we had our glasses because we're signing documents. So I had my local attorney review it. Everything looked good. But it was amazing. We were there, and in line there was an elderly couple that came up to get their license. They had been together like 50 years. Made us look like we were like floozies, you know, for as long as we've been together. But it was like in the same line with folks getting like a fishing license and all this other stuff. But we got our license, and then we got married. This time we got married on the Berkeley campus. We got married at the faculty club. And we did that because Chancellor Bergeneau had been a pretty outspoken advocate. He was opposed to Prop 8. He had always been very kind about LGBT issues, and so we thought that was our way. Shauna graduated from Berkeley as well, and so it was kind of our place to be able to come back and do this together. So I like wedding cake, but after a while, it just, you know, it's a little too much. And so I got to a place where I couldn't kind of watch anymore and sort of sit on the sidelines, and I had to figure out ways that I could get involved. And so I belonged to I decided what I would do. Most of the traditional gay rights organizations, you had options of like phone banking, or you'd write checks and you'd go to dinners. And I can eat, but, you know, it's just not the same. So I found an organization called Marriage Equality USA, and it was a grassroots organization. The whole focus of the group was that we wanted to mobilize couples that were living all across California to be able to get up and go out and tell their story. And so my role, because it's a volunteer organization, I get a nice title, that's why I was the policy director, which worked out well, was that, you know, I'd go through and try to equip them as much as possible with what they might need. So I'd go and do polling research, or I'd go and do, like, research for what was going on in their counties, and I, you know, would share as much information up front so that they could be armed if questions would come up about things that they could say. Although the most important thing really is for them just to talk about that they live here and tell their story. So I've thrown a few quotes throughout this, and this is one from Margaret Mead that says, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." And that is, like, one that I, like, stick up all over the place. It's one I really, really believe in. And I believe in it for this movement. I believe in it for our work. It's something that I think is really key, to not make problems seem so big that you can't do anything at all, and to really see a place and a space where you can do it. And that was really what I thought about this organization was it was a group that would try to set up rallies or have events. We would have tax days. We'd go out and we'd stand on the corners when people were dropping off taxes, and we'd talk about how difficult it was to do taxes. And, oh, my God, it was so hard. We wouldn't believe it. And this is the way we would dream that every single rally would go, right, that you'd have, like, millions of people and thousands of people. And this is the way that it usually went. Grassroots organizing is really hard stuff. And so what would happen is I got pretty good. I mean, I even have on my phone still. I'd have the wire service, the Bay City wire service email on my address book, and we'd be writing up a press release. And we got to the point where I could think of a hook that we could get the media to come out and meet us on the corner that we were going to be at, and we were going to be talking about whatever it would be. And then there would be the panic about whether there'd be anybody else there. But there was one couple that would, like, come all the time, Frank and Joe. They would come every single time, rain or snow. Well, we didn't have snow. Rain. It would be, like, a last-minute call. They would always be there. And in this kind of thing, it was really critical. Frank belonged to a union in the city, and the union wouldn't recognize their relationship. So when they were through and were domestic partners, they tried to get the union to provide them partnership benefits, and they wouldn't do that. So when they got married, they wanted to go back, and they were going to go talk to the union again. And so then at that point I said, I'll put you a briefing note together, and I'll lay out, like, some of the really critical reasons why the union should now recognize your relationship. So then I found this quote here, which says, "An injury to one is an injury to all." And this is a motto of a lot of the labor unions. And it was one that I thought was absolutely perfect and set the frame for the document that I was going to put together. And what I was really trying to think about was I wanted to give something to Frank and Joe so that they would have something that would give them more grounding. But I really had to write it not just for Frank and Joe. I had to write it for the union board that was there. And so I tried to think about a way to do it in a respectful way, but to try to still convince them that this was really critical. So I set this up as a frame. I put it as a quote that was, like, within the document. I started it off as a header to just go poke, poke, poke. But that wouldn't be very nice and wouldn't really help. And then what I ended up doing was I laid out Frank and Joe's story. I talked about how long Frank was in the union. I talked about Joe had a medical condition and he really needed to be able to get treatment, and they were delaying it because they couldn't have any coverage. So really try to emphasize why it was really, really critical. And then I laid out all the other unions that recognize same-sex couples to to make them see that they were really sort of an outlier in what was going on. And I gave them that material. They went in to the union board, and then they came out, and they got coverage, which was really, it was amazing for them, but it was transformational for me, because I got to a place where I realized that what I did wasn't necessarily, I mean, it could be that I just lay out what the facts were, and I could say what the numbers said, and I could kind of walk through and explain things, but I got to a place where I could put something together that could help people change their lives and make a difference. And that kind of transformational power gets me excited. Like, has anybody seen Wicked? Oh, have you not seen Wicked? Because, like, only five times I've seen Wicked, you know? So I'm not going to tell you because I've already said too much. But when it comes back, and you know it will, you need to go and see it. This was going on during the whole movement, and I would go and see it, and it was sort of like give me like the juices to kind of keep going, which is in part, I can't tell you because you have to go see it, but you can't always believe what you see on the outside, and you learn a lot more, and you really try to overcome what's impossible and defy gravity. Well, we'll leave it there. So I took that then back to the office, right? So my social justice cause is public education. And I sit there and I think about some of the struggles that we're having and even some of the discussions that we're having right now with trying to promote added investment or redefined investment in the state back into higher education. And there are a lot of reasons why that's really, really critical. I was working on the Berkeley campus at the time. And I just started to rethink and reframe what I was doing to think about where I could not only satisfy reporting requirements, but where I could really do good and became good partners with government relations units and then with communications to think about ways that we had information that could support advocacy work that was going on. But then I also thought about some of the work that we could do that we could really understand the folks that we were supporting. So how could we make our undergraduate experience better? What were kinds of students that weren't succeeding? What were some of the factors behind that? And really trying to do some research and targeting those places and those audiences. So that was the new frame that I kind of went in with my new inspired stance, was really to try to figure out how I could take the data that we had to try to make a difference with what we wanted to be able to do. I started off by going out and, like, chatting with as many folks on campus as possible. And we did this as an office. We went out to try to figure out the folks that we were working with. And the one quote that I remembered was I was talking with, I think it was Phyllis Hoffman, and she worked for the provost at the time. But she said to me, the chancellor has got a stack of materials like this when he goes away at the weekend. And she says, what are you going to do to get him to pull your piece out of that stack and read it? So then I've got my purpose. I'm going to figure out a document that has, like, the most convincing thing in there as possible. And now I've got to figure out how to present that well. And so the data visualization piece, which Ola is now involved quite a bit in, really kind of came to play. And the first place where I put that into action was with my new boss, and this is Erin Gore. She was the CFO on the Berkeley campus, and she came in, and she came from, she was a UC alum, so she was from UCLA. She knew the University of California system. Her family was all involved with that. But she also came from the business sector. She had a private sector focus. And so I started to do what I did with the union piece, and I started to think about, well, how does she take in information? What's going to be the most convincing ways that I can communicate with her? And then how can I do some sort of things that end up being kind of catching and supportive for what we want to be able to do? And so there's that David Sedaris book, Me Talk Pretty One Day. So I had my own Me Talk Finance One Day, which was my effort to really try to understand financial reporting, the way that they end up looking at information, how I could take the information that we had and reinforce that piece. So we started talking about why Berkeley was a real sound financial investment and thinking about some of the key messages that were there. I got our office, which is the institutional research side, to write the budget plan, which was not what would happen usually because the budget office would generally do this. But I was trying to frame what we would do is that the budget didn't tell us what we were doing. It's really our operations that we wanted to highlight. We wanted to highlight the purpose of why we get the money, not the money and how we end up spending it, right? So I really tried to advocate that what we wanted to be able to do was to get a hold of the introductory frame and present outcomes for the university and what that would be. And then I let the budget folks do the numbers, which was icky. So, which, and I'm a numbers gal, so we would do those kinds of things. But all of this here was to really try to set in a frame that she'd receive and that also advocated some of the key messages. And so that kind of continued to get me to kind of think about things differently. And these are two wacky things. I'll just show you what this is. This is a honeycomb. And in both cases, we were sort of advocating the same thing. It's not much different than what we have here at the system with the campuses. But on the Berkeley campus, there was concern that, you know, in engineering, you can always get whatever you need, right? They can raise funds. They can get non-resident students. You can do all sorts of stuff to support the organization. But what I wanted to convey is that for engineering, it's just as important that arts and humanities does really, really well because their students take those kinds of classes. And then it's just as important as that, you know, some of the research environment that goes beyond that is really critical. So this honeycomb piece, this is one of those chicken scratch things that I gave one of my poor staffers after a weekend and a good glass of wine. My whole point was to say that the campus was really interconnected, that the strength of Berkeley wasn't one college, but was all of this being in one location where a student or a faculty member or a researcher could come and experience it. And it was that interdisciplinary strength that was really, really critical. And that'll come up when we go to the other thing. And then this is another one that shows for students where they're majoring and where they end up taking their courses, which indicates that no college can live on its own and that, you know, in many cases, some of these, half of the students ended up taking classes outside of their own departments. And both of those were embedded within that budget plan so that when we were talking about, you know, what you end up doing, it's really, really critical. And then we have data visualizations, which was our fun way to try to get people out of pie charts and into stacked bars, which are really a much more effective way to see information. I mean, that's my lesson for today. Floss and use bar charts. Okay. So it really kind of transformed the way, and I could see what worked, and then I'd go back and revisit it and try to figure out different ways. But the whole focus was to try to think about what I thought was important and why I thought it was important. So it wasn't just that we were presenting information, but there was a so what to all of it, right? And then thinking about who I needed to get it to and what that would end up being. And then Erin leaves. And she goes off to a different place. She goes to work for a different organization. And as she leaves, she gives me this plaque, which is what I have up on my wall in the office, and it's in that picture that was on that UC Link thing. And it said, life begins at the end of your comfort zone, which I really like my comfort zone. You know, it's just nice. It's kind of warm and it's cuddly. It's just like a really good place to be. And I realize it's a place that I haven't been in an awful long time, you know. So standing on a street corner to try to get people to, like, listen to why marriage was important was not comfortable at all. Going to the marriage counters in Alameda County when we wanted to be able to get licenses and getting turned away, not comfortable at all. Very character building. But also pretty amazing experiences when we start to build them up. And that kind of set me up for thinking ahead. And I got this card for a friend of mine. But then I realized when I go out shopping for other people, I'm actually shopping for myself. So I was trying to give her this card to say you need to buck it up and, you know, get your, be more confident and really kind of think about it differently. So this one here I think is pretty fabulous about really trying to have us see ourselves in a way where we don't pick on ourselves as much as we do, which is not good for us. And so I needed to do that for myself, and then I needed to go along, and I saw this quote from Eleanor Roosevelt, one of my faves who was on the front there, that you must do the thing you think you cannot do. And for me, that was going to be leaving the Berkeley campus, because that became a pretty comfortable place. I mean, I was an undergrad student there. I was a grad student there. I had worked on the campus 16 years. I knew everybody. And I knew who to go to, and I had networks all set up, and I kind of knew how to get our information into meetings and that sort of thing. But when this position came up here at the Office of the President, I stopped and I sat and I thought about it, and I realized it was a time where I needed to make a change, and this was going to be a pretty amazing opportunity because I'd learn about the system, which was, as now I know, is really an amazing place. And these campuses together and the work that gets done and the labs and all the research, you know, it's unbelievable what we accomplish at the University of California. So being able to shift over to that, I thought was really big. But I have to tell you, one of the things that I thought was great was that I'd be working for a female provost, and the president was a female as well. And the feminist inside of me really kind of liked that. That wasn't the same on the Berkeley campus. So so then, this is a hideous photo. I should have, like, gotten this. This has got a wicked face that I've got there, which I think is kind of appropriate. But when I left the Berkeley campus, this is what they gave me. My staff gave me some really nice things, but they gave me a Darth Vader mask, which I thought, you know, that was really something. Because, you know, clearly that means that I'm going over to the dark side. And for the individual who gave it to me, I said, Luke, you're my son. You know? So I believe that humor thing is really, really important. So I play that wherever I can. And I don't know. I'm afraid this may not work if I try this. But, well, maybe let me try it, see if it works. So I had to do a presentation on the Berkeley campus. And this was about 6 months ago. And so, oh, no, I'm not going to have volume on it. Well, let me just do this as a thing. So I started my presentation, and I said, this is a life at the University of California at Office of the President. And I walked through to explain, this is my staff motivational technique. This is how I try to get my computer to work. This is the reaction I get from many. But that I'm still determined. And then I, you know, well, I don't know. This is the Global Food Initiative. And then this is a Super Bowl commercial from way back when. I don't know if anybody remembers it. It's spectacular. And it works so well for my presentation. And so there he is. He's trying to get the card work. I'm still trying to get this. And I call this the decision support system. You know what it is? And then look, wow. It worked, and it's our thing. And look at, amazing! Yeah. So that's the way that I went back. I thought it was really important to use humor in that case, and to go back and say, "Sure, this is the dark side, and let me show you how much we help out." So that was the way that I kind of took it on, and then I found this fabulous thing. So I don't know if you've seen this, but they've got this contest that was going on to try to take, like, food parts and then try to create a collage. And this, look at that. So I'm like, and right before my presentation, I'm like, what's this? So there's this Power of Public campaign that we've got going on here, which I think is spectacular. And another way that the dark side goes green. You know, it's 1 year that I've been here, and it's been a really amazing year, and this is only like a small sliver of some of the work that my team is doing, but some of the stuff that I'm really, really excited about. And my partnership with all of you is the same. So the other place where at Berkeley, I was trying to show the interconnectedness on the campuses and what on the campus and what that was all about and why there was this great strength. But here at the University of California, what I think is that people don't always understand how much reach and how much support we provide the state of California. And so one of the things, Melissa in our office, she's responsible for putting these maps together. And so I came in with a chicken scratch thing after a glass of Merlot, I think it was that weekend, what I wanted. And what I wanted to create was this, like, absolutely indecipherable map that just laid off layer and layer and layer and layer of what we end up doing. But what I wanted to be able to show was this, like, amazing spread beyond 10 campuses, right? That we end up having a much greater effect than just in the Berkeley community or just in Los Angeles or just in Merced or Riverside, and I almost will mention them all, except I'll get down to 9 and then I'll be like, oh. But what this did, it laid out like a lot of the community programs that were going, where our undergraduates are, somewhere in here, our campuses, right? But the spread is much, much greater. And this was the theme of the executive summary that we ended up having in our accountability report, which was really to kind of go through and talk about the impact that we have at the University of California and how broad it is across the state. And then we went through, and then in the first chapter, we peeled this like an onion, and we then gave one map on each of the things to kind of talk it through. But that was a message that I thought was really, really key. The other thing is that I've got my folks putting together these briefing notes, just like the one for Frank and Joe, that are laying out, you know, some of the pieces that we think are critical messages. And this has been a fabulous experience. One of the things that I found in having other people do this kind of work instead of me doing it is that folks are a lot more creative. I would have never come up with that vegetable Darth Vader thing. Never, never. Vegetables are kind of, you got to be careful with them. I love vegetables. Let me say that. Okay, good. All right. I've been corrected on that. So when we got married, we had wedding cake toppers. And my wedding cake topper had a picket sign that said, no on Prop 8. And Shauna's had a basket of vegetables. She's a full Valley gal. So this one here is about social mobility, which I think is an amazing story. And so because of some of the work that our folks have been doing and collaborating with some of the offices, this is one of the things that it just lays out, which is, it goes through and talks about the amount of access that we provide. You know, 42% of our undergraduates are Pell recipients. And that's amazing in comparison to AAU public and AAU private institutions, much higher than any of those. But in addition to just giving them students access, they succeed. So when we go and we look at six-year graduation rates for Pell recipients and non-Pell recipients, it's basically the same. So we get students who are able to come, and then they are just as successful at graduating, and we're constantly looking at ways to continue to improve it. But then the other piece that falls out at the end is what we found is we've gotten access to data from the California Employment Database. And what we found is that for Pell Grant recipients, 5 years after they graduate, they end up making as much as an individual that their family made when they came to the UC school that they attended, which basically in technical terms means they make more than $50,000, which is where we kind of lay out the Pell piece there. But that's demonstrating social mobility, right? I mean, we're able to bring people in, they're able to graduate, and then they're able to go on and make more and move up into middle class and maybe even beyond because of the work that they do from UC. So the other piece that is here is an information center, and this is a big partnership. We're doing this with our ITS group, and we're going to be doing it with the communications group. And so this is like a skeletal thing of the piece, but I just wanted to show you one of it. This is the piece that I'm really kind of excited about. But what we're going to do is create, let me see where I end up here, we're going to create a one-stop place where you can go to get information about the University of California.
And part of it is going to be what I call my web shoo-shoo policy, which is I'm going to provide information that we always get asked for. So I'm at this certain community college, I want to know how many of my folks that applied were admitted and enrolled. All of that's going to be available there. And then I want to be able to go through and lay out in a graphical way the folks that end up coming to the University of California, our transfers, what they look like, and then our financial picture and what that ends up looking like. See, I do this and then it won't work for me. So what I want to do, this is what we're gonna have a little soft release in December. Ola?
Yes.
Yep, good. See? So
I just want to show you one of these, which will be one of the ones on affordability if I find it here, which is the last piece is we're going to have these storyboards. And so we're going to use this technology to help us kind of lay out information that will reinforce the story and then have the data behind it. And it will be a very different way for us to kind of present information. And so what it ends up doing, it's really kind of like a fancy Excel file if you play with Excel, which is really good. We have these little tabs up at the top that basically tell our story, which is we start off and we tell you how much it costs to attend the University of California. And it's about $30,000 before you end up getting aid. This is what it is for the tuition, and then on top of that, what it is for the room and board and all that stuff and what the total looks like. And you'll be able to go through and you can pick out different things. You can look at it by campus. You can look at it for by residency and all that. And then we go through, but then we break it out to really say, but depending on what your family income is, the story is very different. So for people who are below $50,000, you know, it ends up being less than $10,000 for what it ends up costing. But then you can get a better sense of what that looks like, again, providing data across. And then that's what you call a net cost, right? It's what you, there's like the sticker price, and then there's what you actually have to write the check for. So then this one goes through and then shows how our campuses compare to other institutions. But again, trying to lay out a lot of information that will then go through and show what our average is and shows that even with what the costs are, we are ending up right in the middle of the pack that's in there. And then we go through and then we talk about debt levels. This is the percent of students that end up leaving with debt. Which is just over 50. And it shows, though, that when we look at the debt levels, they've slightly gone up, but they haven't increased at levels that are too astronomical when we think about the tuition increases and what those have looked like over time. And then the last piece, then, is to talk about how that compares. And so this is the average debt for those that end up leaving with any debt, what it looks like, and then how that compares to public institutions, private institutions, and for-profit institutions. But with this kind of use of technology, our goal is to try to reinforce as many of the stories that we have with data that we've got out there, and then also be able to free up our time so that we can put more of those briefing notes and that kind of thing. And again, reinforcing all of my goals, which is to try to get information out there that helps us. So that's, I think, going to be an exciting project. And when we get to that place and we have that soft release, we'll send the information around. And the goal of that is then to get all your feedback, right? And it's particularly useful if you've never dabbled in the subject, right? Because our goal in our audience is the public. And what we want to be able to do is write things in a way where net cost doesn't really mean anything to me, but maybe there's a different way. And we get so into the data that it's hard for us to sometimes see. But I really do believe that, you know, after a year, I'm pretty excited of what I think is possible and what we've been able to do and what we will be able to do. And so that, I think, is pretty good. So, and all of this is really hard work. So this is one of my favorite movies here, Leave Their Own. It's always good. So Jimmy Dugan, it's supposed to be hard. If it wasn't hard, everyone would do it. The hard is what makes it great. That's what I try to tell myself. But it is. I mean, this is amazing work we're doing. It is, I think, quite hard. And I think sometimes can be underappreciated, and that's when I go back with my Darth Vader videos, and then I, you know, try to get people to lighten up and see that we're all better when we're all better off, and I think we can do this. So I'll end it with this. These are sort of my little mottos that I could synthesize from my string of gibberish that I've shared with you today. But some of the things that I think are really important. I always believe that it's important to be yourself, which is interesting sometimes here, but I think it's really, really critical to do that. I do believe that we can change the world, I think the more of us that do that, the greater the impact we'll have. I think it's nice to be kind to create a place where we are. I believe in defying gravity, and when Wicked comes around, I want to know what you think, so make sure to go out and see it. I believe in finding a cause, and as I said, for me, this is public education, and then go out and show your creativity. Definitely take risk. We need to embrace change because it's just the way it is, I think we can continue to make a difference with it. Definitely laugh, and then we got to work hard because there's so much to do. But I will leave it at that, see if you guys have any questions. Did I stump you? I know I'm generally a little cautious about presenting stats. That'll usually knock the group off real quick. Charles?
So, you went to Berkeley.
Yes, I did.
And what was your undergrad degree?
I was a math major as an undergrad, which was, that was really hard. It was really hard. It was not like high school. No, that was character building. But I was destined to get out in 4 years. That's what my parents said. I had 4 years. So I was committed to finishing. And then I was a public policy major, as Jenny said.
And then what was your, don't you have to do like a project or something?
I did.
What was your project?
Oh, it was great. So my project was on, this was character building too. A lot's been character building for me, actually. I wrote about the civilian complaint process that the UC Police Department had on the Berkeley campus. And my mother's a writer, and one of the suggestions was to start off the piece with like a descriptive story about like the crazy things that happened in Sproul Plaza and then how a problem occurs and then you know how the civilian complaint process comes up when there's an incident and that sort of thing, and that worked really, really well with my thesis advisor, the chief of police. No, but at that point in time, I think I worked with the audience I needed to. So you know, so I was pretty sure that my thesis ended up holding up the table, you know, to make it not wiggle. But it also got me through the public policy school, so yes, that was very good. All right. Yes.
What surprised you most when you came from Berkeley to UConn?
Let me think about how to say this. Clearly, that's one of the things is what just. There's a lot of hierarchy in this place, and I can say that because, there I am at a spot that's higher in the mode, but I think I was kind of surprised by that, I kind of understand some of it about the culture that we have here. I will say it's something that I try to break down as much as I can within the office and in the environments that I end up working. Because I do believe with organizations, I like to think that our goal is we create a vision about where we end up needing to go, and then I see everybody as a leader to help us figure out where to get there. And it's not having a leadership structure that then tells you what to do. But I think that was probably the part where I feel like some of the biggest differences is that Berkeley had gone through this experience with Bain, there was a lot of pain, and there was a lot of collaboration that resulted with that. I think we're going to end up having a lot of that with here, and it is sort of the initial introduction. But that was probably the part where I sort of started by being more surprised. It's a little formal there, too.
Yes.
It was a long time between Kathleen's departure and your arrival. Did that give you much pause in your decision-making about, you know, what is this place really going to be like?
You know, I... No, not really. I mean, I knew Kathleen, and I had worked with her, and I had worked with some of the folks in the office, and I could see what they had done is they had put a couple groups together to work together. And I know just in looking at how things go on the Berkeley campus and what it takes sometimes to make changes that you sort of expect are going to happen really quickly, that that's the case. I had looked up and I had seen things about Amy Doerr, and I thought she would be a really exciting person to work for. And she's a math major, so I was like, she talks math. And there is a bit of that where it really kind of makes that easier to have a boss that knows what you talk about. So I thought that was going to be pretty good. And then with Janet coming, I thought that could only be interesting, and, you know, that could really kind of make a difference and elevate the role that we could do system-wide. So... organizational change goes in funny ways, but that definitely wasn't a worry for me. And I've got a fabulous team that had done quite a bit while I wasn't around and while they were working on their own. And I think a few of the folks that were in the room took a lead in keeping things going. So that was really great to kind of come in, and they kind of got me up and going. And then we've kind of figured out where we want to go, which I'm pretty excited about as a group. So... No, there.
Well, I already asked one.
There's
always the love of talking with stories and data, right?
We don't yeah.
The story, especially in this environment, without the data.
Yeah.
And then the other side is like,
that's exactly, yeah. What? Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that and I always tell my team to help me remember that, because it's really hard, especially when you're in meetings, and what the goal is to really try to figure out the strongest pieces that we can have to advocate this point and to make sure that we don't go out too far on a limb to be able to try to do that. So we went through and we identified values that we have as an office, and one of the ones that's up there is accuracy. And so that, I'm like, so whatever I get told, the crux of it has to be right. So we have to live with that, and then we can figure out if we have enough to be able to tell a story. But it was interesting, because I was on a group, and they had someone come in and speak about it, and they talked about, if you go in and you present numbers and you show people that, then the first thing they do is they question where you end up getting this kind of information. But if you go in and you tell a story about, like, you know, what social mobility is all about, and this Pell student that was able to get up and then go on, and now this is what they end up doing. And by the way, this is what we end up doing with Pell students, and this is what the story is. That if you construct it with a story up front and then you present the information, people end up having a different place and space when they come into it that they aren't necessarily as quick to do. So I do recognize the combination of those two are really, really critical. But if there's any problem with the numbers, because what will happen is we'll go out and we'll say something like that Pell piece that goes on, and then they're going to want to see the numbers. So we have to be sure that what we say is right. So it's a good challenge. Yes?
I'm really inspired about your use of data visualization. Can you talk a little more about that? I think it's the first example that I've seen. I think did you hire somebody as well to work on?
We got a team.
Yeah.
Because it takes a village to do anything. And we actually have a really, really good team. We're dabbling with Tableau because it was a low-cost model for what we could end up doing. And then we got licenses for, I don't know, about like 10, 12 people in the office, something like that, 14. And I went in and I got one, and I created one, again, really crappy, but with my story. And then I said, look what I can do, and I know you can do so much better. And they have done so much better. But that group has kind of gotten together and really kind of tried to play off of one another, share examples of what they could do and how they could do it. They've been meeting. And, in fact, there's a group in the building that's doing a Tableau user group that's meeting every so often that's doing that on a bigger basis and across the campuses.
But I really believe in the piece on visualization. And in fact, I know all of my data starts with a spreadsheet or it starts with the database behind it, but that's never going to be any way that many of the folks that I need to get the information are going to be able to take it away. And even with some of these data visualizations that we do, it's not going to be the kind of quick talking points. But what I do think it does is if we end up having a story or a line that's really, really important for us to be able to talk about, having a place where people can go in and then get the kind of information that they want to be able to get and understand it, and then thinking about a way that we present it that really reinforces the message that we end up having is really, really critical. So I'll say we are in a process of, like, continuing to do that, and that's where we're getting to a place now about being able to get feedback. Because it's really easy for us to go in and then replicate what we've done. And some of that I think is going to be spot on to do. And in other cases, it could be something where we really need to kind of think about it a different way. Or having someone with the fresh eyes look at it and say, well, this is what it says for me, is really helpful. But I do believe the data visualizations piece is, I think it's a great way to communicate. I also think it's a great way to do some analysis, you know, because pretty quickly you can hone in on what you want to focus in on or really understand what you want to be able to look at. And then I think it unleashes this creative side for folks that end up being really data intensive. And so that gives us a little mind balance there that I think is kind of fun. So, all right. Well, I can leave it at that, and I can thank you all very much for coming on a Monday.
Bye.